Welcome back to Coast AM. My name is Rob Simone, and of course, this is the show where we broaden your horizons. And we tickle your thinking bone. And we have three guests tonight who are going to do just that. Now, coming up in the first 2 hours, there is someone who I have known about for a while, and I can't believe he's never been on this program before. He is co-author of a landmark book called UFOs and the Government, a Historical Inquiry, and it is almost 600 pages long with nearly 1,000 citations from government documents and other primary sources. It is one of these books in ufology that I'm just surprised doesn't come up more, and why his name doesn't come up more. He has been around for 30 years in this UFO arena, and he's a professional author and speaker, and he's focused on the deeper implications of technology, religion, and science for the 21st century life. I would have to describe him as a cross between Timothy Leary and Isaac Asimov. Now, he's written several other books that have gone on to some acclaim. One's called Mind Games, and the other is called Islands in the Clickstream. He is someone you are not going to want to miss a single word of. He's coming up right after the quickie break. And in the last 2 hours, we are going to focus sort of on a holistic approach here. We're going to focus on you, on how to maintain healthy relationships if you're in one. And if you're not, really the best way for you to find someone meaningful in your life. We're going to bring on Mark Michaels and Patricia Johnson, who are a devoted married couple, wrote a book called Partners in Passion. And we're going to talk a little bit about how relationships are really, well, big business. And how, if you rearrange your approach to relationships, you might find yourself in a much better place. So we're going to take care of you, heart, body, mind, and soul. And we're going to do it right after this quick break. Stay right there. Welcome back to Coast AM. And I have to tell you, I'm really excited to be able to share another evening with you. The moon is three quarters full, and it's an absolute pleasure to be here in the nighttime hour. And let's bring on our first guest. His name is Richard Thieme. He is someone who has devoted, well, 35 years to the subject of UFOs, but he's one of these broad thinkers, and he occupies a very interesting place between sort of this new thought consciousness, technology, and security. Believe it or not, he speaks at these conferences for the FBI and other agencies, and they actually request him to talk about the UFO subject. And glad to have you on for the first time, Richard Thieme. Welcome to Coast AM.
Thanks so much, Rob. Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely my pleasure. I was really surprised you've never been on the program before, and so this is a long time coming.
Well, it's great that you asked, and that's all it takes. Have mouth, will travel.
Right. Now, I described you sort of as a cross between Timothy Leary and Isaac Asimov, and that sort of came to me when I was watching one of your videos, and sure enough, 2 minutes later, you read a quote from Timothy Leary.
That was probably the one about you never get the truth from the company memo.
Right. And how sort of truth comes in from the edges.
Well, that's absolutely correct. Some contexts, I was referring to the fact that as a consultant or as a speaker, I always do a lot of backgrounding of the organization, the people to whom I'm speaking. You don't want to be answering questions no one is asking. And one of the things you want to know about is are the real dynamics going on inside the organizational structure. And Leary made the comment that as you travel up the line in any organizational structure, any bureaucracy, government, corporate, or what have you, inevitably you become assimilated, kind of like the Borg or the movie about body snatchers, so that people look the same, but they begin to speak more and more with an alien voice. They begin to articulate the company truth. Watching the CEO of GM the other day is an instantiation of that. I have been able to be relatively successful, and happily so, being on the edges, and that means talking to everybody. I travel into a lot of cultures and connect a lot of dots. And I think I was trying to make the point that when you come into an organization, if you talk to the janitor, you talk to the receptionist, and say, what's it like to work here? You'll often get the unvarnished, direct, clear truth. And if you create the space, often you'll get a call later at home from someone who said, I couldn't tell you this while you were there, but this is what's been going on. And my passion and commitment all my life in the three careers I've had has been to just finding out what's true.
Yeah.
And as Philip K. Dick said, reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, refuses to go away. Mm. And these days, we're in a national security state in which fiction may very well be the only way truth gets out, but then it requires a kind of discernment that it's pretty tricky.
Truth.
These are unusual times, right?
Right. Fiction. Well, let's talk about that. You illustrate a good point in one of your latest books called In the Clickstream, Islands in the Clickstream. And you have a story in there, which is a pretty interesting take on Roswell, the crash at Roswell, where it was a suicide mission.
Oh, that one was, that's in Mind Games.
I'm sorry, Mind Games.
Mind Games is a collection of fiction. The Clickstream is nonfiction.
Yeah, sorry, Mind Games. And where Roswell was an intentional sort of suicide mission for these greys to insert this technology into our culture. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a playful way to pick up a lot of the themes and memes that do circulate around the so-called Roswell incident, the Roswell event. Including the fact that it was an intentional event, and using the use of suicide missions, which are in popular culture because of terrorist acts recently, to talk about how they wanted to know everything about human beings and just got so bored and found it so tedious to hang around cocktail parties and Washington, D.C. corridors listening. So they decided to seed our society with the technology that became the internet, because once we had the internet, we would put everything on it. It interests me that I wrote that before social media came to the fore, before Facebook and all of the kinds of self-revelation that have become commonplace for new generation. So they knew we would project the contents of our psyches 100% onto this medium, and then they wouldn't have to do all that research in libraries, in effect, because humans would tell them everything about themselves, and sure enough, we did. But we're also talking about the fact that I did get a comment from a friend at the NSA, an intelligence analyst, who called up laughing, and he said that story reminds me of 3 Days of the Condor, the Robert Redford movie about a CIA agent who read fiction to find out what was true. He said, 95% of your story is true, but you have to know which 95% it is in order to have the keys to the code. And that was correct. It is a work of fiction. But there is a lot of truth in it, but it's not all true. It's a fanciful story about a true psychic fact, a true psychological state. And it is also true that I start writing fiction again when I was working with some people from NSA ad hoc, informally, and one of them said, you know, you can't talk about these things unless you start writing fiction. And since then, I've published about 35 stories, and I'm working on a novel now that should be finished this year. And 19 of those stories were collected in that collection, Mind Games.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it so often happens that when you think you have an original idea or see something new, you find out a million other people have had it. Well, I quote that guy all the time. Fiction is the only way you can tell the truth,
okay.
He told me. And then I discover there's an academic who's written a wonderful book. Timothy Melly is his name. And it's called The Covert Sphere, Secrecy, Fiction, and the National Security State. And it echoes so many of the themes that I've been writing and speaking about for so long, that with the evolution of the national security state post World War II, the only way, with the degree of compartmentalization, secrecy, and classification that we have, that the truth about what's inside can be told is through fiction. Mm. And sometimes for people inside the IC, inside the intelligence community, because of departmentalization, they often do not know, except by being able to connect the dots, mm-hmm. also.
What the other hand is doing.
Yeah, what the big picture is doing. I was told about somebody the other day who came to NSA, finally got his clearances and began work there. And one of the surprises he got was to walk into the room and find out his parents had been working there all their lives. And he never knew it. And to me, that just crystallized what a bifurcation there is between life at home in the family, which is supposed to be predicated on trust and truthfulness, and the fact that his parents couldn't even tell him where they worked, much less what they did. And he had to get clearances to enter the insider space at the same time. So I do talk a lot about and address the differences between the insider space and the outsider space, because that's what gives rise to so many, quote, conspiracy theories, unquote. It's an attempt to connect dots and understand what's going on in a world in which we know that we don't know.
Okay. Let's go to this point where you made earlier about you can tell the truth only in fiction. You got a great story about the origins of the National Enquirer, which kind of illustrates this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that is nonfiction. Because there's another wonderful book called The Cultural Cold War by Francis Stoner Saunders. It was published as Who Pays the Piper in England and then subsequently here. And it's a very good work of research, very well documented, on the cowboy years of the CIA, the 50s and 60s, when it was feeling its oats and coming up and running under Dulles and with the, quote, old boys network out of the East Coast as the formation of it, the foundation of it, based on some of the relationships with the OS, the OSS. And in that context, I refer to the use of the media for well, propaganda and disinformation. Mm-hmm. And Francis Saunders reveals the depth and width of the extent of the CIA's sponsoring of a couple of dozen of the major intellectual periodicals in the world, in very many countries. Mm-hmm. My own relationship was to Encounter magazine. That's another story. Mm-hmm. And how Steven Spender, the editor, claimed after 20 years when it was outed that he had no idea that it was funded entirely for 20 years by the CIA as the leading non-communist left periodical in Europe. Well, they not only sponsored excellent magazines like Encounter in order to subtly slant the way we wanted the perception management to go, but they also sponsored disreputable periodicals. John Kenneth Galbraith in India, when ambassador, there was one there that he just found was a scurrilous rag and inquired as to who was putting it out. He found out it was the CIA. Well, there's wonderful book called The Missing Times about how a UFO story at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana couldn't get into the national news for many years, despite widespread coverage locally at the time. And the writer, Terry Hansen, discovered that when it finally made national news, it was in the National Enquirer. Well, that had the effect of making it ridiculous. I show slides during my talk, which shows how the juxtaposition of an event like a UFO story with obviously made-up nonsense very subtly and very deeply imprints the notion that this, too, as a theme, as a meme, is not worth taking seriously.
Yeah, it muddies the water, yeah.
Yeah, so the question was, where did the National Enquirer come from?
Right.
Well, and it was founded by Generoso Pope, Gene Pope, in 1953, and it did not make money for at least 6 years. It was in the red. And hundreds of thousands of dollars came into his hands in cash through Frank Costello, the head of the mafia family in New York, which is an unusual way to fund a magazine. And when you ask what did Gene Pope do prior to studying that magazine, you find out he lists in his own resume, by his own statement in 1951, he was doing psychological operations for the CIA, which was relatively brand new then. And then here's someone with a position with the CIA who decides to up and quit and start a periodical like the National Enquirer, which does not make money for at least half a dozen years until the 60s. and which, very interestingly, ran a lot of UFO stories, but they didn't make the most money. There used to be a big cork board in the hallway of the National Enquirer, and it had weekly issues with what the headlines were in the front page stories and how they did. And stories about arthritis or celebrities or scandals always consistently did much better than UFO stories. This was something when you're trying to make a living, you know, and make a lot of money, we know that they tracked. And yet they ran more UFO stories than any other single kind, despite the fact that every time they did, the circulation was not as high off the newsstand for those. And Gene Pope had remarkably interesting connections throughout his life. And Melvin Laird, who was Secretary of Defense, showed up to do the eulogy at his funeral. Now, no smoking gun, right? But a lot of dots to connect would strongly imply at least influence, if not covert sponsoring, of disreputable periodicals, which were so useful for killing stories or discrediting entire realms of inquiry. And you had the resources to do that. And it was very effectively done. So yeah, this kind of disinformation, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's well documented that this is what not only the CIA, but other intelligence agencies do. And the Russians were terrific at it. You know, the Middle East is a good example. The Elders of the Protocol of Zion are still circulated as if it's a real thing. And it was sponsored by the KGB as one means of maintaining and sustaining a kind of acerbic anti-Semitism in the Middle East. Their counterintelligence operations were often much more effective, as have ours been, in securing the end goals of the geopolitical strategy that's on the table.
Wasn't there something
is used for that, even if it was not officially sponsored, but it looks like it was.
Yeah. Well, wasn't there something recent with Cuba and this Twitter sort of company that was
absolutely
that was drummed up? Yeah,
absolutely. And the response to that wasn't that insane to start a Twitter-like communication network in Cuba? But that's not uncommon. I wasn't surprised to read about that. The problem is it's often done in a ham-handed way. When it's very successful, you don't hear about it. When it's outed, and the Cuban counterintelligence apparatus is really good.
Yeah.
So what's
a good one that we haven't heard about?
Well, you're not going to hear about it here either. You can't really disclose things that have been successful that you have heard about, because usually it's in confidence. It's sensitive, even if unclassified information. And in the position I'm in, you don't talk about those
things. I see. Well,
you can talk about what's out in the open, and now, thanks to Mr. Snowden,
Edward Snowden,
we can talk about all of those things overtly. For many years, I could not, although I had a pretty good understanding based on what I was able to put together from what I heard about what we were doing, which Mr. Snowden put a granular face to, so that people could see all of the detailed ways we have used all communication systems to gather all the intelligence we deem necessary. And in a world of information flows such as we have, that necessitates gathering more information than was previously allowed by law and the Constitution, because the borders which contextualize those thoughts in the 20th century no longer hold. And I wrote about this in the early 90s and have written papers about it. That the borders are undermined by the flows of information, which are in fact the engines of identity for people and societies and cultures and countries. Therefore, it was inevitable that following the communication systems, following the technology, you would begin to see these social and psychological and cultural and geopolitical changes in the configuration of identity and boundaries. And that would necessitate, in effect, sucking up everything, so that meta-analysis of the relevant relationships in that data could be mined and used, and it has been.
Well,
they've been very good at it.
It seems to me the war has been lost. I mean, the recent Gallup polls show that more and more people believe there's a cover-up of this UFO conspiracy, and
right.
the government's covering
reason.
Up. And it's do they still spend a lot of time like they used to? Are there still these sort of very suspicious media connections that try to keep things secret?
I can't answer that on the basis of knowing that. I don't think it's trying to keep things secret, because it's not a secret. One of the things I say when I'm doing talks on it, and the talks are on the book that you mentioned, UFOs and Government, a Historical Inquiry. It's a fine work of history.
Yeah. Well, let's hold it right there, because we're just coming up to a break. We're talking with Richard Thieme, and after the break, we will continue going down the rabbit hole. We're going to find out how to hack the connection, this UFO mystery. And he's going to tell you. Just keep it right here. This is Coast to Coast AM. Yeah, welcome back to the program here. We're talking with Richard Thieme, who has written several books, Mind Games. He co-authored a landmark book that's in universities and libraries called UFOs and Government, Historical Inquiry. And we're going to explore the sort of middle ground between security, between this UFO phenomenon. He is someone that spent 35 years exploring this issue, and he brings a lot to it, especially with his contacts in government and all these different agencies. He has talking to some of the greats, and we're going to dive into this more. Welcome back to Coast AM. We're talking with Richard Thieme. And Richard, you've been at this for quite a while. You knew some of the greats in ufology.
Well, the way I have proceeded for the last 20 years as a speaker and writer is to apprentice myself to some of the brightest people in all of the areas that I have explored. That it does include technology. It certainly does include ufology. It's how I've learned. I like to say I try to be the dumbest one in the room, because then all the knowledge just rolls downhill to you, and I'm pretty good at integrating and assimilating and integrating and articulating what I connect. But it's because there are all these people who are all so much smarter than I am around me. And you mentioned UFOs and Government. It's a team effort. There are a number of names on the cover, but the lead people were Michael Swords, who is a brilliant professor of natural science, recently retired at Western Michigan University, who's written numerous academic articles on UFOs. He's just solid as a rock. He's brilliant. And to give you an example of how one learns, I had escalated my connections to the best and the brightest as I worked my way up the ladder, and had come to know Mark Rodiger, the head of KUFOS in Chicago, founded by Alan Hynek, and had reached the level where I wanted to talk at a higher level about what was known and what wasn't known. And Mike Swords was so generous as to come over from Michigan to Chicago and spend an entire weekend saying, ask what you want. It was like a tutorial. And so I'm indebted to people like Mike. And the other major co-author of that book is Robert Powell, a nanotechnologist who'd been with AMD, and he organized this very complex project. You know, we met once and agreed that we were going to do this book, and then spent almost 5 years creating it, never meeting again in person, all over the internet. And that was in part because two of the, again, towering figures, Barry Greenwood and Jan Aldrich, who had pioneered the use of FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, to get documents back in the 70s and forward, who just tirelessly, obsessively spend hours combing through archives, turning over documents, both electronic and paper. All three of those guys, Swords and Jan Aldrich from Project 1947 and Barry Greenwood, who wrote Clear Intent using Freedom of Information Act, received documents that the government had denied existed about visitations across the northern tier of SAC bases and missile bases. These were the great people. And so by allowing yourself to be part of a team with such extraordinary people on it, you inevitably learn a lot.
Yeah.
The other thing was I've done a lot of interviews, and mm-hmm. I used to write for Information Security Magazine, and interviewed, again, the best and the brightest. And on this subject, I have interviews on my website, themeworks.com, with, for example, Edgar Mitchell, or with Joe McMonagle, the remote viewer, who is one of the most successful in terms of hits and details in the remote viewing, the Stargate program and NSA and the CIA. And those are really great interviews because it enabled these people to tell their stories and to have and to share their insights in a way that is really, really clear.
Yeah. Edgar's been on a guest on the show.
I've been at it for a long time, but it started 35 years ago when I was an Episcopal clergyman, and I was sitting in the church basement in 1978 with the senior warden of this little parish, my very first, on the edge of Hill Air Force Base. Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the movie, was in the theaters. I'd read a lot, Hynek and Jacques Vallée and Kehoe and books like that, and I was sitting there with this fighter pilot who was a heavily decorated fighter pilot. He retired from the Air Force as a colonel, a bird colonel, very much a right stuff kind of guy. And I said, "Bob, you know, I read about these things that you guys chase them in your fastest fighters and can't catch them. And what's the story?" And he said, "Well, you know, that's right." And he looked perplexed, which for a cocky guy wasn't common. And he said, "We chase the damn things and we can't catch them."
Mm.
And that was the occasion for me of a contextual shift from "Isn't this cool and interesting and fun?" to "My God, this is real. I want to find out everything I can possibly learn about this." And
yeah.
I did, as a clergyman and then as someone going all over the world doing speeches on technology, talking to people in security and intelligence all over the world. Mm. And trying to create the opportunity for people who wanted to talk about it to do so and know that they could trust me as a former clergyman to hold the same kinds of confidences. But then, you know, it's funny, Rob, it's like on Sunday morning I would preach and you couldn't ever talk about the things people had disclosed, but you had to address their concerns. And you learned to do so through symbols and meta statements so that everybody thought, well, they're talking to me. And you learn to do the same thing in security and intelligence and in ufology. If you can't disclose something directly and who said it and what exactly they said, you can nevertheless integrate what they said with the other things you know and make meaningful, intelligent, insightful statements about the domain. And ufology requires that more than anything else. It's a field that is awash in disinformation, misinformation, projections, confusion.
Oh, yeah.
But there's a hard core of granular truth in it, and that's why we're so proud of that book, UFOs and Government. It's almost 600 pages, and there's not one thing in it that, like you said, isn't sourced.
No,
to
it's
a government document or a primary source.
It's bulletproof. Well, so let me ask you: there are people though who do disclose, who don't have a problem, who don't hold allegiances. And one of them, right off the top of my head, is Julian Assange. Now, do you think? He has made a small statement regarding the UFO issue, but do you think he's holding more that he hasn't released yet?
I don't know. I probably could find that out, but I haven't asked that question. What he has said about it was not significant. He said there were discussions of it, there were references to it, but it wasn't like a smoking gun. It wasn't like what that poor hacker in England was looking for that got nailed.
Gary McKinnon.
Yeah. Searching all through Defense Department computers, which is probably not where you're going to find it. But where you will find it is in mistakes, things that are inadvertently revealed that, for example, State Department doesn't know that something's classified. I mentioned compartmentalization. And if you don't know that something's classified and you reveal something about it, the person who does know it's classified can't come out and say, "Oh, that's classified. He shouldn't have said that."
Yeah.
You say nothing.
Yeah.
And so learning to read between the lines and to take the relevant documentation, it goes back to my very first career. I taught English literature, and I learned how to do research at the University of Chicago. Those days we had what we called libraries with paper and indexes and books. And I taught courses in how to use bibliographies, how to go in a nested way down from top level to bottom level. And source material correctly and to make sure you had good observations and solid documentation for it.
Yep. Well,
ufology has both.
Yeah.
Craziness and it.
Well, let's talk about ufology. How do you hack the UFO phenomenon? Because I know you speak a lot of these conferences that deal with security and computers. So they would pose a question like that, but you are the person that can actually give an answer.
Well, first of all, let me see what I mean by the word hack, and cut me off because I tend to go on near the boss of this conversation. But hacking is an obsessive, passionate, and daring need, compulsion to know things and know how something works that has been applied primarily in the computer domain. But it originally came out of MIT in the 60s and wasn't about computers. It was about cleverness and insight and funny.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily just mean the negative connotations.
No, it's taking something that's very complex and ceaselessly, tirelessly, you know, doing whatever you need to do to find out how it works. And again, apprenticing yourself, it's a meritocracy. The hacker world is a meritocracy where if you show you've done everything you can, then your questions are entertained. And I referred to my own methodology. It's very much like that. You do everything you know how to do to show you're serious. You don't go to somebody and say, how do I hack? You do everything you can to learn how to do a particular thing and then say, I'm stuck here. And they will recognize that and welcome you into the conversation. Well, you hack ufology the same way. You do all the homework you can. You do all the serious research you can. You learn to develop a BS detector because there are misinformation agents and disinformation agents and people who say things that they know are not true because it elevates their status in the eyes of their peers or gives them marketing opportunities or what have you. And so you learn to be skeptical. You have to be a real skeptic, not what the skeptics call skeptical, which is debunking, but genuinely skeptical. Bring a scientific attitude to the domain. But when you do that, you learn that we've got something going on 60, 70 years here from in the modern era at any rate. Since 47, we mark Kenneth Arnold's event as the kind of arbitrary beginning of that.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot of data, an awful lot of data. But the waters are very, very muddy. Coral Lorenzen, who was one of the founders of APRO, said back in the 70s that she thought the government was going to begin desensitizing the population to the existence and the reality of it. You mentioned that more people believe in it. The more educated you are, the more you believe it's true. And you know something has been withheld or covered up or managed, to put it that way. And she said the government is going to begin desensitizing people. That was in light of a major wave in the mid-late 70s. And they're going to do it through entertainment. Now, I've had people in Hollywood tell me, in effect, the same thing, that if you want someone you want to get into somebody's head and plant ideas, you give them mind candy. And also, it protects you from the destruction of your reputation, something to which I would, you know, reasonably be subjected to now, by saying this is something I think is true, and it's easy to destroy somebody's reputation. I have seen that done effectively, and that's how you asked earlier how influence is done in the media. Well, it's done by manipulating the context, which makes it unthinkable for most people to raise the subject of UFOs seriously. But Lorenzen said that we're going to have to let people know because they can't control the phenomena. They could not and cannot control the phenomena itself. It isn't ours to control. And she said they were going to do this through entertainment. And if you go back to the 70s and then look at the movies and TV shows.
Explosion.
Since then. A veritable explosion. Now, how much of that is influenced, encouraged, or actually funded and sponsored as part of something intentional? I'll never get to that level of knowing. But you can say it's certainly interesting that more and more and more people do believe, as you say, that something has been withheld and covered up. And if you look at the data, like in our book, which is work of history above all, we like to say if you see the nose of a camel in the tent, you're going to figure out there's got to be a camel attached to it. You cannot look at what we document of what the government has been doing in response to this. And the government is, you know, many things, many components, often fighting among its own components, among itself, without coming away saying, this is real. This is something that was said in 1947. This is, or 49. This is real. It is not fiction. It is not visionary. It's a general who said that. And they knew that. They knew that from the very, very beginning. And therefore, that we're still asking the same questions about the phenomena.
Well, that leads amazing. Me to wonder, knowing everything that you know about the subject, which is vast, you've talked to a lot of people about it. You know about Nick Pope, who used to run the UFO desk for the MOD. You might be aware that at one point he confirmed that there was a shoot-down order for at least the British government for a while. And who knows, maybe it's still standing. Where are things today? Do you think that there's a still hostility? Have we weaponized space? Or is there, it has been some sort of a connection and treaty? What's your best guess?
Well, there were shoot-down orders here, too. I know Nick Pope and people we both know. There were shoot-down orders. There was one in 1952 near Washington, D.C. We have the documentation for that people were told to load their guns, and if something came in again, open up, which, according to the pilot, is a highly unusual thing to do over a populated area. But there have been other stories, which are not as easily confirmed, about shoot-downs or attempts to shoot them down, and response, like the Cuban plane that was allegedly shot down by a UFO, or the dogfight, for which we have a DIA document, Defense Intelligence Agency document, in 76 in Iran over Tehran, in which the avionics were interfered with and the armaments were shut down on a plane, which could have been dire. We have that document, and it's cited as having the highest credibility.
Mm-hmm.
So you're asking a really – I don't want to go wandering off, but you're asking a question that has so many branches to it. It's so difficult to know. We can know some things for sure. We know that it was managed. Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo 14 astronaut, told me that he went to intelligence liaisons with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and said, just tell me, is there some sort of organizational structure that is extant that manages this? And the answer came back to him from a general, yes, and don't ask another question. But you can infer that, of course, policy is determined by people in rooms. It's not a conspiracy. They meet in secret, they determine policy, and then they come out of those rooms and execute it. That's just the way everybody operates. So, of course, you can infer that the actions taken about the management of perception of this phenomena were intentional, were in by design, and were for good reason. One of the things we show in the book is that national security concerns, especially at the start of the Cold War, were paramount. Were they ours? Were they Russian? Or were they extraterrestrial?
Yeah.
They didn't even ask the question, were they multidimensional? Did they exist in other dimensions, in the fifth dimension, like some theoretical physicists posit on brains where gravity is bled off, which accounts for the weak force, et cetera. They didn't even talk about multidimensional reality or the multiverse.
No, with the big red threat at their doorstep.
No, it was simply space, Newtonian space, not Einsteinian space.
Right.
From here to there, how did they get here? And you still hear that.
Yeah.
They couldn't get here from there. Well, they could because they did, because they're here. And that's something I've had people say from DIA and others at NASA, they're here. We know they're here, and there's nothing that is going on in translunar space around our planet that we don't know. We know that we have observational capacity, depending on how we calibrate it, to observe everything. You could say an astronaut will be here, an asteroid in 4 days. You can be sure that we have all of the means of the electromagnetic spectrum monitored.
Yep.
Obviously.
Well, not only that, there has been that unmanned shuttle, that military shuttle, that's been in space for some 300 days or more.
Yeah.
So what's it doing up there all that time?
Well, we don't know. A good friend of mine, Bill Scott, a retired senior journalist for Aviation Week and Space Technology, wrote pieces about the space plane. It took him years to get permission to run that piece, but they finally did it. There are several space planes, and that's something else that muddies the waters. As you know, we really do have a lot of really arcane and exotic and revolutionary technologies on the drawing board and in test phases. And we are developing some astonishing things. And UFOs have been used successfully to cover up events in relationship to that. There were sightings of the U-2 that were allegedly UFOs and were allowed to be, but nothing like the large numbers that the Air Force claimed can be accounted for.
Oh yeah.
So what is really going on? I mean, the bottom line is you're saying what's going on? And at that point, I can only be speculative. All we could do is infer that there continue to be reasons why this subject is managed so successfully and so resourcefully. Somebody thinks there's something that needs to be managed about it, and my guess is national security concerns in a much more complex way, not simply attacking.
Yeah.
But what would happen to our structures, our political structures?
It actually points to maybe even a bigger scenario that has to do with national security that, who knows, might still be in the closet. Stay right there. We're going to come back with another hour talking with Richard Thieme. His website is themeworks.com. It's linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. More right after this. Stay right there.